Welcome to the Danielle Strickland Podcast. We're glad you're here. We hope this episode challenges and inspires you, disrupts and invites you to go deeper and further with Jesus. For more resources, go to daniellestrickland.com.
Danielle Schroyer, welcome to the podcast. So this is the Danielle Strickland Podcast. This is the Mind Blown season. And the premise for this podcast are scriptures, theological ideas that we thought we sort of had a handle on, but then we were like, whoa, these are either different from, or we were wrong about this in all the right ways. Like, we're so glad that we were wrong in so many areas. And, you know, I have a whole story about how your book, Original Blessing, was a part of one of my mind-blowing journeys. But before we do that, I wanted to ask you, what is your mind-blown journey? Like, when we told you the premise of this podcast, wait, and I forgot to say, you're a writer, speaker, you've got loads of pastoral experience, you're a graduate of Princeton Theological Seminary, an MA in theology, you do all the things. So and you're a spiritual director?
Yes.
So thank you for being here. And maybe you want to just give, like, you know, a little bit on who you are besides your official bio, and then tell us one of your mind blown experience and what you were wrong about and you're so happy.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. It actually ties right into what I did for a good 20 years of my life starting out, which is that when I was young, I felt called into ministry, but I was so shocked because I'm not a kid who really felt God's presence the most in church. I've always felt really close to God, but church has been kind of the hardest place for me to find that connection.
Yeah.
And so how to navigate that through my life, thinking like, oh my gosh, I feel this is such an important relationship that I have with God that feels very natural. And sometimes church is the place that's hardest for me to feel that. So I thought, I'm just an odd candidate to be called into ministry. And I remember my first, like probably my most important mind-blown experience was that when I was in a church my freshman year at Baylor University, and it was just different than any other church I'd been at. Like, they were playing secular songs, the pastor was in jeans. This is all very cliche now, but in the early 90s, I was like, what is happening? And I remember sitting in the pew and I thought, oh, I didn't know you could change church. Like, my mind is blown. I thought we had to do it this only one way. And then I realized, sitting there as a freshman in college, the way we do church isn't always the only way we've done church. Like, we have thousands of years of history where we've done it probably a whole bunch of different ways. And I wonder if we could just like change how we do church for people who right now it's not working for. And I just remember being like, this just changed my life. So then I thought, okay, all right, I'm in. Like, if that's what I'm being called to, then like, count me in. So I actually spent 20 years thinking, if I was designing a church for people like me who feel deeply connected to God, but maybe the stuff in a traditional format don't work, what would church look like for me? And so I had an independent emerging community of faith that I pastored, where we tried to reach out to people that fit that demographic. And so we made it sort of more artistic, more holistic. We certainly had lots of different changes in theology and the way that we kind of talked about God and understood God and engaged with scripture. And it was just a deeply connected community of faith, which was a really fun way to spend 20 years. And now I spend my time as a spiritual director, which is just to say, I do that same thing on a one-to-one basis. You know, right. Say, okay, there's lots of different ways to pray. There are lots of different spiritual practices. Let's figure out what wholeness in God looks like for you and how we can sort of see what God is up to in your life. Because I think God's always moving people towards wholeness. So,
amen. You know, I think that's so fascinating because it almost feels like your own pastoral experience is deeply connected to this whole thing we're talking about.
Yes.
Right. Which is like, I didn't know you could change, right? Like, I didn't know this wasn't stuck, that you have to fit into this. I didn't know the structure thing could actually flex and you could try some things out and discover what works, and that there are different things for different people at different seasons. I mean, I just think it's hilarious that we all just feel so stuck all the time. with a, especially when we're talking about God, who is always, you know, even the Bible, right, which has like different things for different folks. I mean, literally, yes. Maybe they'll hear it through a prophetic act. Maybe they'll hear it through a historical story. Maybe they'll hear it through, you know, a living person, you know. So I think it's so fascinating that we're so, what do you think we're so afraid of? Like, why does it take us so long to get there?
Well, I wonder if part of it is that we actually, I mean, I think it comes from a genuine place that our, if our faith really matters to us and it feels sacred to us, we don't want to do it wrong, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I know early in my life, it was like, oh, I can't deny that I feel this way, but also God matters so much to me that I don't want to be a jerk about it, you know? So I wasn't going to be the person who's like, this isn't working for me. Like, you guys are terrible. You know, it wasn't, I didn't want to be that person. But I also just couldn't lie about the disconnect I felt. And so I think honestly, sometimes people's frustration with theology or church or, you know, just institutional religion, I think it comes from this real place of that intersection between not being able to lie about sort of our embodied gut feelings about something and also just really wanting to honor the sacred. And that gets messy, right? I think it gets messy for people. And then I do think, you know, a lot of times, depending on your tradition or how you were taught, you can't just walk. I remember walking in, actually talking about original blessing. I remember walking in and thinking to my teacher, like, it seems like Eve had a really valid question there in the garden. I mean, I thought she was going to throw me out the window, you know? So we have experiences where we do ask our questions in church, and they're not always honored. They're not always seen as sacred when we have these questions that are coming from a genuine place. And so I think that also tends to shut us down. And we just assume that we're not allowed to ask those questions. And so over time, God gets smaller and smaller and smaller in our heads, even though the reality of God is this wide, expansive, you know, freeing experience.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
That's a really heartbreaking thing, right? When, as you say, these people that are bursting with questions and excitement, and then are either given a stock answer that doesn't quite resonate or just aren't given an answer at all. It's like, no, she's wrong. Well, why? Like, tell me, like, I presume the question you're referring to is like, don't you want to be like God? And the answer to that is like, yes, right? The whole point of sanctification is that we become more and more and more like God. Like that is what we should strive for every day. And in my thoughts and actions and words and postures and priorities, I should seek to emulate Jesus Christ in every moment. But it's bad when Eve does it. And okay.
I know. I mean, as a 6-year-old or whatever, I was like, I just need you to explain to me what Eve did wrong. Like, this, you know, this serpent or whatever was like, do you want to be like God? And she said, yes. I mean, the evil thing would have been if she was like, absolutely not. I'm not interested. Peace out on that. I'm just going to be not God. You know, of course the Sunday school teacher just could not remotely explain to me why I was wrong about that question. She just was so mad that I asked that question in front of these other impressionable children. And then from then on, I was like, Danielle, don't ask questions in Sunday school. Like, I had them, I just kept them to myself.
Wow. That's the saddest thing, right? Like the takeaway for you as a young kid and for so many people in church right now is just don't ask. Let those, and what happens is then we let those questions become this distance creator. Because when we think if it's not safe to ask in church, it's not safe to ask God. And then we just have this like distance that we create because we have this dissonance, like this doesn't make sense to us. And I was just doing a video yesterday for Barna around the millennial, you know, a Gen Z generation, just asking the questions and wanting to ask the questions and kind of exiting the church, not because of a desire to leave God, but this like absolute refusal to keep going through motions that they don't understand. And I thought, wow, what a refreshing generation. Like, and then I also was thinking that challenging to leaders, because I feel like a generation of leaders have been told your job as a leader is to have answers to the questions. Instead of your job as a leader is to hold space for good questions, like to just wrestle through together with good questions and to be able to say like, I don't know for sure, but like, I'm not afraid. And God certainly isn't at all unsettled by our questions, right?
Like, which question do you think God hasn't already thought about or heard from another person? Like, I just like, are we really doubting that God has room to, you know, to hold that for us? And I remember telling, you know, when part of the emerging church conversation for years, I would tell seminary students, I would say, listen, what you need to know is that for generations, people just respected you because you were a pastor. And I'm just telling you, those days are over.
Yes.
People are going to question you more because you're a pastor, and your job is to earn their respect and earn their trust. And if you're not up for doing that, they're not coming, you know? And if they come into your church and they don't know what the point of any of it is, you should like explain it to them. I know one Sunday every year at our church, we did a whole service that was just like, here's why we do things. And so we got up and we were like, hi, we start with a welcome. The reason is because we want to be a hospitable place. We always begin with a collect, which is an ancient prayer of, you know, whatever. Like, we went through every little thing, and it was super informative for a bunch of people who wanted to be part of these rituals, but a lot of them didn't cut from the church, or their tradition was very different than what we were doing at Journey. And like, if we don't explain it to people, how are people going to feel invited in, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway. I also really love and I think this is really our posture too. And I hope our listeners hear this too, is that we're not saying like, oh, boo hoo, we used to be these terrible people who believed wrong things, and now we're like saved in some sort of progressive liberal, you know, utopia or something like that. That's not it at all. We actually realize that we don't have to be so afraid of asking the questions, of getting it wrong, of wrestling it through, and that we would say that we are still on a journey. Like, I'm pretty sure there's a lot more I'm wrong about even right now. Like, I think this is actually just a really right-sizing posture to say, like, there are so, I mean, literally, we're never going to know fully until, you know, until we get face to face with the glory of God. And even then, maybe it'll take us an eternity. That might be the whole idea, but we're never going to know. But the idea to lose the fear around the not knowing, it's okay. And the discovering of what might possibly be good. So Danielle, I was tucking my son Moses into bed, and we had this ritual that we do. And I put him to bed and I say, Moses, and he is my last son. He's 8 years old now, but he's always just been like literally the personification of joy, this kid. I mean, his face is lit up. He's always like open-eyed, wide-eyed, you know, happy all the time. Even when he was a little baby, he used to wake up in the middle of the night laughing instead of crying. It was the weird, I was just like, who is this child? But anyway, so I would say to him at night, you know, Moses, you know, who made you? And Moses would look at me and he'd say, God made me. And I'd say, he sure did, honey. And how did he make you? And he would say to me, he made me good. And I would say, he sure did, honey. He made you fearfully and wonderfully and good. And then I would leave the room. That was like our nighttime ritual. And I remember one time I left the room and I shut the door behind me, and I was like literally emotional. I was just feeling this, like, I don't know, emotional reaction to that statement we had just done together. And what I realized just in that one moment, I realized that I actually had believed my whole life, based on my own theology and what I had been taught, that I wasn't good, that I wasn't good. And so all these questions began flooding into my mind. And I was like, I think I might be a heretic. So I went into my bedroom, and my husband was there, and he's much more conservative, theologically minded anyway, you know, like, he's just that way inclined. And I said to him, honey, I just got through doing this thing with Moses, and I was wondering, like, when does he turn bad?
Oh. Right?
Right. And then my husband looked at me totally deadpan, and you have to know him, he's very funny. He's just totally deadpan. And he looks at me and he goes, I think it's around 7 or 8.
we know the answer to that question.
And I was like, okay, but walk me through this again. Why, when does it, what, like, and what is that based? And I was just like, literally at night, like, it's like, and my husband's like wanting to go to bed. And I'm just like, where did we get that? Like, why do we believe that? Like, where does it say that? And like, how did that? And I just was like, so then the next day, I couldn't let this go. The next day I'm Googling like original sin, like total depravity. Like, where did we get these ideas? And almost the only source I could find was yours. An original blessing, your book just kind of popped up. And I was like, so I read your book, and I remember reading your book, it was so helpful to me personally, just in my own mind-blowing, you know, I think I might be wrong about this. And I think some of these tenets of these doctrines, especially taken too far, are so destructive to people and so destructive to our witness to the world even, and even just me personally in my own healing journey. And I was reading the last four chapters on a plane of like, your, why did Jesus die? You know, like, let's get to that. And I'm just weeping. I was weeping on this plane. You know, the poor guy next to me is like, are you going to be okay? And I was like, I don't think I'm ever going to be okay. Because like, why Jesus died in this idea of like, you know, getting Jesus out of this transactional debt payment and into this relationship and example of sacrificial love and the outpouring of everybody being welcomed into this beautiful thing. I mean, I just, this is so beautiful. And anyway, so I wanted to thank you so much just as a fellow pilgrim and journeyer. And just, I just so clearly remember that moment in that hallway after putting my son to bed and going like, this has got to, I have got to at least try to figure this out. Mm-hmm. Tell me how did you write that book? Because it was such a beautiful ministry to me. So thank you. But also like, where did that beautiful book come from?
Well, I mean, it really did start, I think, in that Sunday school class where they were like, this is why you need Jesus, children. You know, and I'm like five thinking like, what did I do so wrong? I just did not get how they explained Jesus, which was really confusing to somebody who just wanted to be everything for Jesus, you know? So I had all this like deep passion, and then they were like, it's because you're bad that he had to bleed out for you. And I was like, what did I do? Like, I don't understand.
You
like,
hung him there. You pierced his hands. You held the nails. You're like, I'm five. I don't know.
And I remember praying to God. I mean, so earnestly praying to God when I was little, like, please, I never asked you to make him die for me. Like that, I'll just let me die. Like that just seems like a way smarter thing. Jesus seems great. We should just let him live. And I, you know, just the whole thing was really confusing. And then I remember the Eve story of like, isn't the whole point that we want to be more like God? And so as you can imagine, I've been grappling with this question for a very long time. But when I served as a pastor for people who were trying to hold on to Jesus in the midst of a bunch of really hard questions, I couldn't help but realize that original sin, it just all came back to that. That was the linchpin for all the mess that they couldn't really figure out. And I just honestly got so angry about it. It just was so sad and frustrating and hard to watch people not let God love them and not let themselves off of the hook and realize that this is just absolutely the worst setup for somebody being a faithful disciple of Jesus, for them to think that they can't be a faithful disciple of Jesus because something's wrong with them. And also God did it, you know, it just, what a mess. Like this does not make any sense. So it's the first thing I did when I stepped down from being a pastor. And one of the reasons I wanted to sort of find some more space in my life was because I needed a couple of years just to like all these things I had thought for so long and all this theology that I read over time. I mean, I knew what I felt. I didn't know how to say it. So I just spent 2 years like thinking, reading, praying, and thinking like, what's the best way to explain this whole thing I've been struggling with since I was little. And so that's how the book came about, is I wanted to give people a really encouraging way to just consider that it might be true that you could see the world this way. You know, just like you actually have an option here. And original sin is not the oldest thing in our toolbox theologically. And, you know, if we look broadly, it's the one anomaly. Like if you take all world religions, Western Christianity, we're the only weirdos who say this very negative, pessimistic view about humanity. And all the other spiritual leaders across all time and cultures, which if you believe that God is the creator of the universe, that has to count for something, right? They've all said, we have this basic goodness to us. We are meant to live into it. We're meant to bless others with it. And like only Western Christians have said, oh, it's a mess, you know, you're born sinful and separate from God. Like, we're the only ones, which just seems insane to me, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think that would be part of what people are afraid of, is that we would lose our distinctiveness. And that, you know, I think even when people hear this, so maybe you need to give the listeners just a quick primer. But I would also say to the listeners, please buy Original Blessing and read it. Even if you know, you think you're going to really disagree with it, read it anyway, because I think that idea that maybe there is a different way. And, you know, this is really interesting to me in my own, you know, in my own life, when I've done a lot of work with people who suffer from oppression. Mm-hmm. And my message has always been to them, you know, that the greatest revelation of God is that he made them just like he made my son Moses. Like, they are, regardless of the circumstances of their birth or the things that they suffered, like, and this is, there's so much power in that message. I mean, you can feel it as you communicate it. So you're like, like, this is so powerful of a message. And then it gets like negated, but you're actually horribly sinful to the very rotten core of your human self. You know, like, you're like, what just happened?
We phrase that as good news, right? Like, people send me, I'm a pastor, people send me things and I listen to them sometimes. And again, that kind of the four spiritual laws on which, like, you know, evangelicalism is founded, and, you know, that first law, and it's like dripping in privilege anyway, because someone coming to me and say, God loves you and has a wonderful plan for my life, I'm like, I know, I'm like a white educated man, I have a job I love. Like, honestly, like, you, there's nothing you can do to me. So, like, that's
clearly the Lord loves me.
Yeah,
right.
Obviously the Lord, yeah, duh. Like, what are you, this is redundant. However, if I go to someone who is lacking many of the privileges that I lack, like, or historically, that all of a sudden that doesn't ring true. And then the second law is like, oh, but you're sinful and you're separated from God. Like, oh, wait, what did I do? Like, I don't understand. Oh, no, but this is the good news. It's like, it doesn't feel like good news right now. How can this be good news? And I've been obsessed with this recently, that, like, how can the good news, and again, I think what you do, Dan, I'm on the call with two powerful Daniels, Daniel Schreier, what you do so well is, yeah, you reinstill this idea, but also say that, and I mean this as a compliment, this isn't some new thing that Daniel Schreier came up with a few years ago. This is like, oh, what were we saying about ourselves? What was God saying about us since before Jesus? What were Christians saying about Jesus in those early instantiations of Christianity? I'm like, oh yeah, of course we're good. Like, God made us. Like, how dare we have the temerity to say we are anything other than very good, which God himself says right at the beginning. And we're like, no, we know better. Like, what insane idolatry that we should put ourselves above God in that moment and say that what he has called very good isn't.
Like, yes. Well, and I think that's actually so important. And I went to a Presbyterian seminary, so there were a few Calvinists around. It wasn't as many as you'd think, maybe, but, you know, I had some arguments. And I would say, like, if you understand the sovereignty of God, I don't get why you think that humans get to say that what God said about us isn't true. Like, how dare you? How dare you? Like, at no point did God say, well, you were very good, but then you ate this fruit and now the whole thing is messed up. Like, we do not see that in the scripture. And so for us to come up with this whole thing about how it's no longer the same, you know, it's no, like, that goodness has somehow been evacuated or dissolved, is to deny God the sovereignty of God's own creation and created intent, which is goodness for us, blessing for us to share and have and give, right? How dare we? It's exactly right. Like, if you care about the sovereignty of God, you would never say that.
And yet something is wrong.
Yeah, this does not mean that sin isn't real, right? And I think that's the number one thing that people are like, oh, rainbows and unicorns, of course, you just think everything's great. And I'm like, no, actually, when you move over to Original Blessing, you have the freedom to say, wow, some things are really messed up, because you don't have to take it so personally anymore. It doesn't, like, shut you down because you don't feel so shamed that you don't have any activity or agency to do something about it. So you have to say, you know, I think the heart of the matter in Original Blessing is, you know, the fruit that we ingested, metaphorically or whatever, is that we are capable of both good and evil. We contain the knowledge to do what's good and the knowledge to do what's evil. And the whole purpose of human life is the tension that comes between that and our hope that it produces wisdom in us. And when it produces wisdom in us, the reason it we get to wisdom is because some of the times we choose wrong. Like, God is not shocked. God is like, yes, sometimes you learn through mistakes. I hate to tell you, but it's not going to be a rose garden out here. Like, you're going to do things wrong. And the best way to find wisdom in that is to acknowledge that and say, huh, that did not go the way I intended, or I did not have the best, you know, I didn't, that wasn't coming from my best place. What is that about for me? What can I learn from that? Okay, great. I'll take that and move on. Right. And we also can give ourselves credit that, wow, you know what? I really showed up and did like a really powerful, amazing thing for a person right then. And I'm allowed to feel good about that because I'm literally designed to feel good about that. And I can give myself that credit and give God that credit because it helps me do it again, you know? So there's a fullness in original blessing where there's goodness and there's sin, there's brokenness, there's harm, there's violence, there's injustice. All of it is part of human life, and we don't have to separate it out and say, you know, there are these very definitive buckets about where they go. We have to be aware of all of it all the time, you know?
And I think that's even taking, what that does is it takes sin more seriously, because so easy, yes. I see this in a friend of mine who did some things that he really shouldn't have done. That's all we need to talk about. And he says, oh, you know, we're just inclined towards sin. I'm like, no, you don't, like, you don't get that as an out. Like, that's not like, well, I was just paralyzed by that. No, you made choices. And again, we make choices that harm ourselves and harm people, and we should constantly strive to not do those things. And no point am I saying it's okay. I'm saying that let's own it. And again, let's move on from it and grow from it and not be like, well, sin nature. Again, the idea of sin nature being that whenever you have two choices between sin and not sin, you will choose sin. That's what a sin nature means. And I'm like, this is objectively untrue. Like, when I jump behind a car, I don't go, I'm going to hit every pedestrian I see.
Like, right.
When I go to a store, I don't go, I'm going to steal everything I can, and then I'm going to punch someone in the face. Like, it just doesn't occur to me. Like, that's not my nature, right? Like,
yes. Yeah, I think there was I can't remember exactly how I put it in the book, but there was something, and my editor was like, I just feel like we should take this out. And I was like, you can't take this out. This is so important. But I said, like, okay, let's think of like how many murders we have in the world. And I was like, what percentage of people did the murders? You know, like, if original sin was true, we would all have murdered at least one person by this point. Like, that's what, if you have two choices and you always choose the bad one, by the time you're 30, you've killed somebody. Like, that's just math. Do you know what I mean? Like, this is, how do you not get that? And like, I get it that murder's bad, but I mean, it's like 0.01% of the, you know what I mean? And like, yeah. What are even those circumstances? How much of that is structural? How much of that is about poverty or racism or, you know, like, oh my gosh, it's complicated, you know? So, and again, I think the beauty and the gift that original blessing gives us is just as you said, James, that the thing that gives us the ability to honor our own choices and also be responsible for our own choices is that we trust that there's love underneath that. Yeah. Like, you know what's okay? I can look at myself and say, wow, I really messed up, because I know that there is this net of unconditional love that's holding me underneath that bad choice I made. Yeah. And so that gives me confidence and courage to look at myself in the mirror and just be super honest about what I find, which means the good stuff and the really not great stuff, you know? And I can say, okay, gosh, that's awful. I got to change that, you know? And yeah, you're right. You see it all the time. This dissociation from our sin that comes from original sin. And that not only happens within us, but with other people. We write other people off. We're like, well, he's terrible. He's an awful person. She's a bad apple. Like, you know, we can collect massive amounts of groups of people and say that we can write them off because we dissociate. And so original blessing requires us to have this deep sense of interconnection, that we are all here to be together and bless one another. And that means that we're all really responsible for our siblings here, you know?
Yeah.
I also think, you know, like I was thinking this week even of, you know, really terrible Christian leaders behaving badly and, you know, people going, well, we're all sinners, you know?
Yeah.
And you're like, what? Like, again, that's James, like, oh, well, then I guess we're all just going to be like, it's like this so fatalistic and pessimistic and like, and also like clearly not God's design. Like God's not going to set people up to be abused by Christian leaders because they're prone to sin. I mean, it's like, what? So I also think for me, Danielle, one of the things that was really helpful about your book, because I think people, again, like you said, are afraid of not being faithful to the scriptures or not being faithful to God. So they're afraid of the undoing of this, like, if original sin isn't true, you know, then why did Jesus have to die? You know, back to this, like, then is it all just some sort of fabrication and we all really just should join Oprah's book club and think great thoughts all the time and we'll be better people. Right. But like, for me, it was really helpful even to think around sin instead of as this inherent, you know, thing inside of me that was bending me the wrong way, was almost more inclined to like a sickness or like a cancer that takes over my original design of goodness, right? So the enemy, so then the enemy is sin, right? The enemy, our collective enemy, is this destructive thing that would destroy or mar the image of God in other people and in me. And that Jesus then gives us a power to fight together, you know, so it gives us this power that we wouldn't naturally have, but we have in Christ this power to fight this cancer, you know, or this sickness that is in the world. Does that jive, or am I just trying to like?
Yeah, no. And I think the reason why the healing metaphor and the medicine metaphor is really helpful, and the early church used it so much, is that if you catch it early, it doesn't become cancer. Do you know what I mean? Or like it's tiny.
Yes.
And doesn't that ring true to how sin works in our lives? Like it a lot of times it becomes a habit. And
right.
So the more you do that, it grows, right? And the more that sort of metastasizes, it becomes more and more of a problem. So I would say it's also not just about sin, but about death, right? And that the stuff that connects us to other people is life giving. You know, Jesus keeps saying, I have come to give you life. Like, mm-hmm. I'm the good shepherd. I want you to have this pasture where you're just coming in and out. You've got this freedom. You got your green grass. If you get lost, I'm going to come find you. Like, mm-hmm. There's so much joy and safety here. And when we live into that, we feel this sense of abundance. And when we cut ourselves off from that or try to cut other people off from that, mm-hmm. we're choosing death, right? We're choosing this thing that doesn't bring life. Mm-hmm. And that is what cancer does too, right? That is what a virus does. Like it takes away the health,
yes,
and the vibrancy and the energy and the life-givingness of our system. And
yeah.
So even though our systems are designed to breathe and do all the things and we can heal, our bodies are meant to heal ourselves. Like we have to work with that healing, you know? And I think this is how we understand how the spirit works and how what Jesus embodies for us is like, let me show you what it means to live this kind of life that is not only healing for myself, but I am actively seeking to heal others, and not just physically too, but like, there was one teacher that I had that said, you know, it's so important to remember that the miracles that Jesus did didn't just heal their ailments. It healed their ostracism from community.
Yeah.
You know, the leper was outside of the city, and that is its own sense of pain.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
The healing is also, again, joining back into that sense of connection and community that we have. And so, you know, it's all of life is included in this healing. I think it's so much better to see sin that way. And it just makes more sense. Like, oh, sin is disconnection. Like,
yes.
Okay. It's really as simple as that. Like life comes from connection and sin comes from disconnection, you know?
Yeah. And I think, so just to, you know, I'm married to a man who loves the four spiritual laws. So again, just to say, Steve, we love you. And
yes, Steve, you're amazing.
Yeah. And also like, and praise God for like, and I also think this like ongoing revelation, like I just see this as like more, you know, even like less corrective and a little bit more like discovery, like it's better than we thought. Like, so this idea that like, okay, maybe there isn't, you know, this idea of like all of us being born bad is not only not true, but also the ramifications of that not being true is better than we thought. Like, it's good news because it actually elevates Jesus and elevates the idea of what Jesus wants to do and invites us into and to be part of. And it elevates connection and relationship and, you know, ways in which we can be more honest and authentic instead of just self-depreciating and hiding and, you know, afraid and never acknowledging things that we need to acknowledge. And then also, I think that idea of like, you know, this fatalistic, pessimistic outview on all of humanity, which the outcome of that has been so painful in the world, you know, as we judge people and as we criticize and condemn people, which is the opposite literally of what Jesus came to do. He said, I didn't come to judge the world. He literally said, like, this is not why I come. So even all those judge room analogies, I'm like, guys, you know, Jesus literally said he didn't come to judge the world. He came to save it, right? He came to heal. So I love all those analogies. I think it's really powerful. What do you think, what has been your biggest, has it been well received? Do you get a lot of kickback? Like, what has been the reality of you writing that book?
Yeah.
You know, can't be happy.
Well, so, it's funny. I get this question a lot and I have to say, I was just so pleasantly surprised. part of that I think is because I quite honestly prayed every single day when I wrote this book, that it would in fact be a blessing. Like I certainly am always try to be intentional and thoughtful when I write a book, but this one just felt like it was so important because it's so tenuous for people to just think there might be another way of seeing it. And so I have just never prayed more over a book. And I also just had to get really clear with myself that like, this is not for everyone. There are some people who are 5-point Calvinists and just are going to stay that way. And this book is not for them. You know what I mean? It's completely fine. There's a million books in the world. And this one is for the person who is really struggling to maintain a connection to their faith because they're starting to see the cracks in the system in the same way that I did. And they just need some permission to say, you're not the only one that has had this question. And actually it's biblically valid and you could hold on to that and still stay in this, you know?
And actually this is church tradition.
Yeah.
Like, and again, we keep, and I think we're in a season, I call this a reformation season of the church where we're realizing like, oh, a lot of things that we held to as this like tenets of our faith are actually just things we constructed.
Yes.
In certain eras of Christendom that actually the return to the Beatitudes and the person of Christ and this like early church, sort of how this played out in the world is actually truer and most truest to the tenets of our faith. So there is something really beautiful about rediscovering this original blessing of the gospel.
Yes. Well, and I try to tell people too, I'm like, I know that we've been conditioned to read original sin into it, but it's not there. And so as you're reading Paul or Jesus or whatever, I just want you to remember that they're Jewish and they couldn't have possibly come up with this very weird idea that we have come up with because it just doesn't fit. Like it's a complete anomaly to the way they saw the world, their paradigm, their philosophy, their theology, the way they understood God. Like it does not fit. And so we can go to scripture confident that that is not what Paul was thinking about when he was writing anything in Romans. He was not thinking about original sin because it was hundreds of years before we came up with the idea of like the individual in the way that a Western person understands it. Like,
right.
That wasn't even a concept yet. Paul would be like, what are you talking about? When I say you, I mean communal you, you know?
Yes.
So I think that's helpful too, just to remember like, okay, we can't go back and sort of find this purity in the scripture of exactly what they meant because we're living in 2021. But there are some things we know, and that can give us some confidence to say, okay, as a deeply faithful Jewish person, Jesus just didn't see the world this way. And so what was he maybe trying to tell us that we have now in the tradition forgotten that's important for us to know so that we can be faithful? You know? Yeah.
For listeners who are listening to this and they're like, what? What's happening? What would you recommend for them?
Yeah. I mean, I did write the book for that exact thing. It was like, here's like a, you know, step one, step two, step three, like through the process of just how you could maybe start to think about it differently. And I mean, the one thing I'd say is Genesis 1-3 has a lot of different ways we can read it. And honestly, that fall narrative is probably the least reliable of all the ways that we could read it. Mm-hmm. If you ask, you know, Hebrew scholars across the ages, like it's pretty tough for them to say that's what's in there, you know? And so, okay, well, that makes us ask some questions about, okay, well, if that's not what it is, what can we learn from the story? What does this story have to offer us? You know? And I think the gifts are just so abundant. It's just hard not to say that that's a good way to go, you know? And again, I joke right now it's Lent. And so I always say, you can always give up original blessing for original sin for Lent. And if you missed it, you can pick it up, you know, like if you really feel like there's something you don't get to have at the end, like the day after Easter, just start believing in original sin again, but just try it on, you know?
Yeah. I've been following your tweets. They're great that way. You're giving up original sin for Lent. I love it.
Just try it. And then which I think the thing that people are worried about is like, oh, I'll just become this, you know, anything goes liberal, or, mm-hmm. oh, sin just won't matter anymore. And I'll just be, you know, it'll just all be, like you said, we're just all reading Oprah's book club and none of this stuff matters. And,
right.
you know, when you try it on, you realize, oh, actually what happens is I feel like I have a lot more responsibility to care for people, and you know, we're our brothers and sisters keepers here. And, oh man, I got to be honest about like my own spiritual life. And I have to take Jesus seriously when he says like, yeah, do it, do this stuff. You know, I'm not like joking about it. I'm like, go out and be faithful and do these important things, make changes. My kingdom is here waiting for you to like live into it. So like do that, you know? Okay, well, I have to take that really seriously now because I don't have these excuses of like, well, the devil made me do it, so I just have to be like a really bad, you know, not paying my taxes capitalist or whatever. Like, we can't, right?
I actually have to feed the hungry like Jesus did and yes. what he told me to do. I actually have to visit people in jail like Jesus told me to do. I like, oh, all of a sudden this becomes, yeah, rather like, well, sin nature and we're all sinful and they're more sinful than me, but we're all equally sinful. Weirdly, like their sin seems to have a lot more consequences than mine does. Do you know what I mean? Like, even I'm loathe to bring it up, but like the consequences for Ravi's sin didn't really affect him in his life, right? Because it didn't come out, because you explain it. And actually, like, no. Once that stuff is out there and we start taking sin, as you say, really seriously, then we want to be part of the resolution and part of rather than just go, well, you know, as say, well, we're all just sinful. Like, okay, that seems really fair. They're like, well, both abuser and abused are sinful. So what are you going to do? Like, well, I'm going to comfort the abused and I'm going to call to account the abuser. That's what I'm going to do because I believe that you're both created good. And I think that you have violated your goodness by this violation. And I think your goodness has been violated, but actually you can't ever take that from you because God has called you very good and ever matters what anyone ever does to you because you are very good and you can't take that.
Yes.
I do. I also agree. I think the ramifications of, and this was the big surprise takeaway for me, I think even when I was reading your book, Danielle, is that even as I view Jesus through that lens of original goodness, it just made him sweeter. I mean, it just made him better. Like I fell in love with Jesus again. Like I just was like, oh, he's better, bigger, you know, other than, you know, just that whole, like even reverence for what it is that God's about in the world. And, you know, I've dealt a lot with a lot of injustice and human trafficking. And what I would say is like a depraved human being. I've seen, you know, kids just abused as like babies. And I mean, just, and you're just like, what explains that, you know? And I understand this like desire to go like, oh, there must be something wrong. Right. And I would say, yeah, there is something wrong, but the wrong, you know, is not embedded on the inside of us. It is this sickness that can take us over. Yeah. And really, I think it can take us over. I think you can die, just like you can die of cancer. You can die of sin.
Yeah.
And you will die of sin apart from participating with God in this design of being a blessing. So,
yeah. And there's pain under that too, right? Like,
yes.
When there's disconnection, there's pain. So there's like this tragedy to it of like, okay, what made this person do this evil thing? You know, and all that study that I did about sociology, and it's like, We seek affection first. We seek affection. We seek affection. And then only on like the 10th time where we don't get affection do we turn to violence. And it's because we're so heartbroken and angry that we didn't get the affection, you know? Right. So this is true in the animal world and it's true in the human world. So, you know, the abused become abusers and it's this terrible cycle. And the way to break that is to say, do you know how beloved you are?
To actually give the affection. Yeah. So this was also a big takeaway for me because people kept saying to me, I believed in original sin for me because I was like, I actually had some issues. So I was like, oh yeah, for sure. Like I get it for me. I was like, and then actually it wasn't until years later after a lot of counseling that I realized I actually wasn't a bad kid. I used to even describe myself as a bad kid. Like in previous interviews, I would be like, I just was a bad kid. Cause I was like always the one smoking drugs and getting kicked out of Christian camps and selling, you know, stealing cars and like all the things. But then I realized years later, I realized actually I was a hurt kid. Like all this sexual abuse came out, like all these neglect things. And I realized like, oh, wow, I was a broken and a hurt kid that disguised themselves as a bad kid. And then I remember people saying to me, like, if you don't get it, just wait till you have children. And so I was like, okay, great. So then I have kids and I don't think my kids are, exceptionally amazing, different from other kids. I think they're amazing, but they were just good. They were good. I just remember going like, these kids are good. And then I'd be like, even when they're seven, when they're eight, if they're bad, if their behavior is wrong, my literal, like as a mother, I go through a list. Are they hungry? Are they angry? Are they lonely? Are they tired? Because those are what's happening here. I know my kids are not pro, even if like they hit their brother or something, that relationship's broken. They're not okay. They're not like, oh good. I told my brother, like they're not, they feel terrible. Even if they're the ones that won the fight, they feel bad. There's a brokenness here. And I'll say, what is going on? Cause I know that this is not they're not bent towards this. So what is happening? And all of that was like, you know, oh, this doesn't make any sense. And I think that just, if that's even your takeaway, that just like walk it through, it doesn't really make any sense. Right. It's actually not really true. And that if you pull this thread, it might just unravel some things that will help you see God clearer and see Jesus more, you know, better. Like I guess what I'm most excited about this mind blown process is that when you can lose the fear, you'll find more and more love. And that more and more love will lead you to Jesus in a way that you can really participate in blessing the whole world.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I think that's true with kids and also they're brand new humans. Like there's just some stuff they don't know yet, you know? So it's like, we have this, I love that Hildegard of Bingen talks about this original wisdom we have and that across our lives, we have to build into that original wisdom and let it grow so that we can eventually live in it like a tent. Mm. And I love that visual because it's like, when our kids are, you know, I have teenagers, so I'm like, they're lovely people. And they also kind of make some dumb mistakes because their teenage brains are weird, right? And they're learning. Right. But my job is to say, well, that's because your tent isn't fully set up yet. You know, like it's going to take your whole human life working with God, right? Mm-hmm. To figure out what wisdom looks like for you. And of course you can't live in your tent yet. You're 16, you know, nobody has a fully formed wisdom tent at 16. That's not because you're bad. That's because you're human, right? And right. So we have these developing capacities and it's so empowering for us to realize that part of living faithfully as disciples is that we just practice what it means to be slightly better versions of ourselves. And we do that by seeing how God sees us. Like we let that image of God within us be the thing that guides us instead of these labels. Sometimes they come from the outside, like I was a bad kid or whatever, which are just responses to disconnection that we have, you know?
Yeah. 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 And anyway, all this is awesome. I could talk to you all day, but I'm absolutely thrilled that you agreed to be on our podcast and that you wrote the book. Thank you. And for all the work that you do. So if people want to connect with you, Danielle, what's the best way for them to connect with you?
So my website is danielleschroyer.com and I'm on Twitter at dgschroyer. And that's probably the easiest way to connect with me.
That's awesome. Well, we're cheering you on. We're grateful for you. Keep on going, keep writing, releasing to the world the things that you're learning. We're grateful for it.
Thank you for having me on. It was a great conversation.